Welcome to Edu Leadership Radio. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and my goal with each episode is to bring you the best in professional practice from real school leaders. My guest this week is Dr. Tyler Brown, Assistant Superintendent of Schools in Mount Vernon City School District No. 80 in Mount Vernon, Illinois. Our topic today is working with students from poverty and Mount Vernon School District's one-to-one computing initiative and how it attempts to address the needs of students from poverty. Dr. Brown, thank you for joining us. I wonder if you could start by maybe telling us a little bit about your role and in your district and kind of how you got interested in this topic and became involved in that work.
When I came to work for Mount Vernon City School District 8 years ago, we were working under a leadership model of DLLPs and DLLPs, which was District Learning Leadership Teams and Building Learning Leadership Teams. And we had monthly meetings at the district level and at the building levels. And one thing we noticed with these learning leadership teams is we were really struggling with our academic achievement with our students in poverty. So our district, our learning leadership team at the district level started researching what we could do to really help our students from poverty. 10 years ago, our district had a poverty rate of about 40%. Today, our this past school year, 2010-2011, our poverty rate for the first time went over 80%.
So a big change.
A huge change. And when we started researching this topic back in 2004-2005, our poverty rate was approaching 70%. So we've continued to grow since then in our poverty numbers of kids. So we began to research it and really needed to find a solution to help our students in the classroom and help our students. We needed to learn more as educational professionals of how to better serve our students from poverty households.
Right. And I'm guessing during that time, did your population of educators stay about the same? Was it a pretty stable teaching force throughout that time?
It's a pretty stable population. Although during that time we had a significant amount of retirements over the last 10 years, our teaching population has turned over, I would say, probably 40%. Mm-hmm. But roughly still the same teachers and with our mentor teachers training our younger teachers and how our district's set up, yes, we still have a lot of the same makeup of teachers.
Right, and I think that's the case in many school districts where the student population has changed dramatically in just a few short years, but the teacher population, the educator population is roughly the same.
So, that's exactly correct.
Yeah, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about what your district has done or the work, some of the work that you've done maybe with other districts to help teachers become aware of some best practices for working with the changing population of students. Yeah.
Well, the first place we started was building a relationship with AHA Process, Dr. Ruby Payne's organization, and that was back in 2004, and I was one of 8 people that we sent to become certified trainers with their organization. Since then, I believe I'm the only one out of the 8 either still with the district or a lot of the people, I think 5 of the 8 are still with the district. Most of them were due to retirements, but I'm the only one that has kept up on my certification. I've done a lot of presenting regionally and statewide on the topic of poverty, and we trained every staff member that year with their day 1, day 2, and day 3 trainings, and as well as every month that year in 2004, and then the following school year, our 8 trainers followed up every month with doing additional training, and it was almost refresher training because we'd gone through the 3 formal days of training. But that's really where we started. I've gone to a lot of other conferences since then and heard a lot of people, a lot of different experts talk about poverty. I still think Dr. Payne has the best organization as a whole and the best model for people to really understand poverty.
So as you've presented that material to different audiences and talked with educators in a variety of different settings about working with students in poverty, what are some of the first things that educators say to you, or what are some of the first things that you hear when working with a new group of people and introducing this topic for the first time?
Well, I think some of the first things, there's quite a few first things I hear. Many times when I go into a district that has seen an increase in poverty student population, I hear a lot of frustration from the teachers and administrators, a lot of lack of understanding, because what we don't think about a lot of times in education is most of us come from middle class homes, and almost all of us live in middle class homes ourselves now, and the middle class values and the middle class norms are so deeply ingrained within us, we don't necessarily understand what type of life or what types of rules or values or beliefs are in poverty households. They're very much different. If you think about as a middle-class person growing up in a wealthy home, and we very much understand that people from wealth, their values, their lifestyles are very much different than middle-class, but many times we want to blame people in poverty because their lifestyle is not like ours in the middle-class. And a lot of times the wealthy look at the middle-class the same way the middle-class looks at people in poverty. They don't understand the values and the norms that occur there. So I hear just and I use the word ignorance here, I use that just because we're ignorant to the poverty lifestyle because we have no experience there. We usually have no training there. And that's where our staff, so much of our staff, and we saw major gains, even the 1 year later, we saw major increases, almost 20% increases in our achievement scores in reading and in math just 1 year later. Not that we were changing what we were teaching or how we were teaching a lot that first year. Most of that gain, academic achievement gain, came from how our teachers were interacting with students, how they were understanding. They just had a better understanding of the mindset of the kids, the lifestyle they were coming from, the values of the home, parental involvement, parental interaction. It really changed how we, I would say, more our customer service in than our delivery of instruction into our families and our students.
Hmm. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about what kinds of perceptions staff have had of students before and after this training. How have you seen those perceptions shift specifically?
Probably some more empathy toward the students and how we deal with them. Very, very different. For example, students in poverty very much think they're fated to do something. They believe in fate stronger than they believe in a brighter future or a choice. There's choices to be made to be able to have a different lifestyle. The missing, just that whole, I'll give you another example. When I was a principal before I came to this district as the assistant superintendent, I got a call over Thanksgiving that one of my students' mother had passed away. She died, she had asthma and had passed away. So I get a call from my secretary saying, you might want to call this family over Thanksgiving break because I'm not sure they're going to have the clothes or other things they might need for a funeral. So call the dad and ask. He said, yeah, we definitely, the kids only have jeans and long sleeve t-shirts. They really don't have any clothes for the funeral. So I said, I tell you what I'll do. I'll give me their sizes. I'll go get clothes for them and I'll drop them by the house tomorrow. So I did that. And what did I find whenever I went to the house? The house was in poor condition. But when I walked in, there was the biggest dog you would ever want to see that, of course, cost a lot to have because you have to feed the dog. I walked in to the biggest big screen TV that I might have seen at the time. They didn't just have they had the latest gaming system at the time. It was the latest Sega model at the time. That was 10 years ago. And they didn't just have one or two games. They had a stack of games. They had a satellite dish on a roof that could barely support the satellite dish, and on and on and on the things they had in there. Because what we fail many times to see as a middle class family is we pay bills before we pay for entertainment. So if there's an emergency and the air conditioning, the HVAC in your house breaks down, you're going to pay to have that fixed, and you tell the kids, we're not going to Six Flags this month, we'll have to go next month. In poverty, so many times entertainment is medication for poverty, because poverty, nobody wants to sign up to be poor and live poor. So entertainment is many times the cheapest medication or medication or relief from living the poverty lifestyle. So there's entertainment there. So when you walk in there, you say, why, these must be horrible parents, because they have all these games, all of this electronic stuff, all of these things that cost money, but they don't have clothes for their kids. But it's the entertainment piece that I think our families have really started to understand that value and that lifestyle. And I always tell another story to our teachers. I said, you know, if a wealthy family or a wealthy friend gave you an original Monet worth $20 million to hang in your $60,000 or $100,000 home, what are you going to do with that? Well, I'll tell you what you're going to do with it. You're going to get on Google and you're going to find the best manufacturer or the person that can produce the best print of that painting, and you're willing to pay a few hundred thousand dollars to have that print made in your home so nobody can tell that it wasn't the original. And then you're going to sell that original because it makes no sense to have, you know, a $20 million painting and a $100,000 home. And I think whenever we hear that story, we say, well, the only difference between us and the middle class and the people in poverty is there's just a few more zeros on what we're willing to get rid of. So as a teacher, when you buy a student a pair of $50 shoes and the kid comes back on Monday without the shoes and you say, where are your shoes? Well, my family pawned it so we could go to McDonald's and a movie that night. It's easy for us to say, I'm never helping that child again because of what they did. And I think that's what's really changed our teaching staff, is they look at our kids differently and the actions of their families and themselves, and we see them very differently.
And that perception, the perception that you know, that families do have their children's best interest in mind, but maybe just operating from a different cultural mindset or a different perspective, I think is one of the most valuable things about Dr. Payne's work and about the understandings that that educators can develop when you know, when they have access to that kind of information. I wonder what you've seen in terms of how teachers and other staff have changed the way that they approach working with students based on that knowledge.
Well, I think it's helped strengthen the relationships that you mentioned. Really trying to strengthen relationships with students with mutual respect, and that's one of those large pieces. Another thing that, you know, we've really not got into the instructional part of how our teachers have changed. One of the other things is trying to come up with concrete examples of abstract thoughts. And this is another big piece of Ruby Payne's work, that so much that's missing in poverty vocabulary is words for the abstract and abstract concepts in students who grew up in poverty homes. So we have to be working with students to develop models or hands-on activities or visual representations of abstract ideas. That's one of the major changes that I've seen our teachers doing. Another thing that we've done curriculum-wise is we've really started to go down the balanced literacy trail for our teachers, where we were moving away from teaching literacy in a traditional method, really looking more at a balanced literacy. Gretchen Courtney and Associates is the vendor we use, or the expert we use to guide our professional development. Mountvernon.com, really that's built on the five pillars of reading, which is, you know, vocabulary and comprehension, fluency, phonemic awareness, and phonics. Especially in the area of comprehension, every month we have a different comprehension strategy that we go over, and it's the strategy of the month. And we've really tried to get these strategies, which are real abstract ideas or concepts, such as predicting, summarizing, connecting, questioning, inferencing, imaging. Every month we take another one of these abstract concepts that are major parts of literacy to try to make them a little more concrete for kids. And, you know, working through that balanced literacy model of having read alouds and shared reading and guiding reading and independent practice and working with words in a 90-minute literacy block every day, but really bringing to life and to concrete examples predicting or summarizing or any of those comprehension strategies. That's just one area in our curriculum, how we've really changed to try to help out our students in poverty. Another step we're going to take this next year is we're going to go to a one-to-one laptop initiative that every student, teacher, and administrator, grades 3 through 8, will have a laptop-type device. We're looking at going with the ASUS Transformer tablets and the keyboard docking stations with those, so the kids later in the year will be able to take them home with them. But again, putting the world at the students' fingertips through the internet and through having a laptop device for every child. We're hoping to work with businesses throughout town to have Wi-Fi hotspots and other areas like housing projects to have Wi-Fi hotspots, so kids will have internet whenever they get home to be able to expand learning beyond the school day.
Wow.
Also, another major problem in poverty homes is the lack of print. And of course, with being able to download books through so many different apps, they'll be able to take books home with them to be able to read. And what we find is one of the major, the largest deficit that our kids from poverty come to us with is a lack of language and a lack of vocabulary. In kindergarten, we see poverty kids coming in with an active vocabulary of somewhere between 400 and 800 words upon entrance in kindergarten, where our middle-class students are coming in with 3,500 to 5,000 words in their active vocabulary. So we've got to make up that difference. And that's another thing our teachers are doing. No matter what they're teaching, they're always teaching vocabulary and language to our kids to try to grow their vocabularies so that they can get not only on grade level or even with the middle class peers, but to close that gap so that they can keep moving forward to be on grade level or above.
And I'm interested in the technology aspect of that, because I think some people would say that's a bold move to put technology into the hands of families who have not had access to it in the past. But it sounds like that would be a way both to increase connectivity, but also to increase access to print, as you mentioned, books in the home, access to reading material at home, but then also access to the wider world of the web and all that has to offer. How did you arrive at that solution to obtain one-to-one computers for your students?
Well, I've been working on my board for about a year. We went to the state board conference, the statewide board conference, this past October. And while we were there in Chicago, I knew the Apple store was there. So I just made a casual appointment for all of our board members to go over to the Apple store just to see a demo and a one-hour lesson about an iPad. I was just wanting to plant the seed. And whenever we left there, the board said, and we'd been kicking around going to paperless board packets as well, the board said, well, I want you to go back and start writing grants, because we at least want the middle school, grades 6 through 8, to have a laptop on every student desk no later than the next school year.
Wow.
And I was just hoping to plant the seed. They also walked out of that store with an iPad for every board member. We, the next month, started doing paperless board packets. So we started at the top with the board starting to do their board meetings on iPads, which then the teachers and the administrators noticed the board using that. And we did a tutoring program after that and purchased some iPads in a tutoring program. And that was very successful, where we purchased some for students to get their hands on. We also purchased we gave laptops to two special ed classrooms this past school year after the board conference. We did that, I guess, right after Christmas to pilot in there to see how well that went in two special ed classrooms as well. That went wonderfully. So I came back, wrote a grant, and we were successful in getting this grant, and the grant's going to pay for the majority of the devices, grades and like I said earlier, every student grades 3 through 8, every teacher and administrator will have the Android tablet device for this upcoming school year. Also, those other netbooks that we purchased for those pilot projects and that tutoring program, we're turning those into wireless mobile labs for them to be used grades K through 2. There's a lab that they're going to be able to roll in there, because I'm not sure yet that I want to roll out a one-to-one initiative in grades K through 2, because there's so much of, especially with our poverty kids, we've got so much foundational work to do with our kids K through 2 in math and especially language, that I just want them to have access to the technology as resources to push in. Because I see grades K through 2 that it just be a tool to do a few projects so they're introduced to the technology. Grades 3 through 5, I see them being used daily, but not really decreasing the importance of the teacher, that it's almost a 50-50 guide, where I see students seeing teachers K-2 as the source of information, to grades 3 through 5 being the teacher is a source of information and the device is a source of information, to where when we get up to middle school, grades 6 through 8, that the teacher is more of a facilitator for learning and the students are using the device to search out much of their own learning and much of their work.
I'm reminded of the similar transition that takes place with literacy, where we talk about in the primary grades, students are learning to read, and then in the upper grades, you know, from maybe third grade on, students are reading to learn. And it sounds like you're saying the same thing is true of technology, that in the initial grades, the teacher is helping students get to where they can become more independent learners and use that technology to access information in a way that might not be possible earlier on.
Yeah, that's very, very accurate.
Oh. So congratulations in getting that grant. That sounds like a huge victory for your district, and certainly a bold experiment and a great opportunity to find some new things that work. I wonder how you decided on the Android tablet. Did that offer different flexibility or cost benefits?
It did, and I'm not selling or supporting any device over another.
Sure.
The Asus tablet, I went to ISTE in Philadelphia just a couple weeks ago and learned about a lot of interesting things for us. The iPad problem for us is we're PC-based everywhere else, and that would be the iPad would be the only Apple product we would have. The second major problem that we have with iPads is the lack of supporting Flash. And so many things that we have as resources for our kids, such as Study Island or whatever we might use, requires Flash, because we know education vendors use Flash because it's quicker and cheaper to produce web products with Flash. So many things that we would use in an educational setting, we need to be able to access Flash. The other major piece, as opposed to doing like a netbook as to a tablet, is battery life. The thing that that scared me the most is that teachers would not utilize the device if they're dead all the time. If we're looking at a battery life from 2 to 6 hours,
right.
I see teachers saying, oh, they're always dead. And every time I want to do something, two or three students' device is dead. What we're excited about the Asus Transformer, battery life is much like an iPad. It operates just like an iPad or an Android phone. It's just like a large Android phone. But battery life, 9.5 hours. When you dock it with a full-size keyboard, it actually clicks in, operates as a netbook with a touch mouse on it. But the real interesting thing that Asus did there is they integrated another battery in the keyboard. So you get 6.5 hours off of the battery in the keyboard for a total of 16 hours of use per charge. And that's really what sold the device to us for the uses we're wanting.
Wow, so that's the keyboard itself is wireless as well, so that
yeah, well,
that gets
it
plugged
actually,
in later.
The tablet actually clicks right into it, and it looks just like a netbook.
Wow.
And the other thing is you can close the lid, and then the screen is protected because it looks just like a netbook, a front- and rear-facing camera. It's got HDMI out on the device itself and a micro SD card. The nice thing about the dock as well is it has a full two regular USB ports and a full SD port as well. So just like today, I was testing it just to see what it would do. I can plug my my USB mouse into it. It works. I can plug my USB keyboard into it that I use on my regular laptop. It works. So it really brings in the whole functionality and opens up the world of USB devices that you can attach to it as well. So it really gives us the best of both worlds as a netbook or as a tablet. The only problem is it's Android-based instead of Windows-based, so there's some things that you could do on a Windows device you can't do on an Android device yet.
Wow. So I think there's another argument to be made for that type of approach, and that is this idea of digital citizenship, that part of our job now is not just to teach literacy and math, but to teach literacy with technology, to teach literacy with finding information online and learning how to interpret it. What are your thoughts on the other changes that come along with this, the other opportunities that you're offering to students who will be living in a world that is that is wireless, that is highly technological, where a lot of communication happens online? What do you see coming down the road in terms of that world that you're preparing students for?
Well, I mean, when I was in the classroom, I was a computers and business teacher, so this has kind of been an area I've been in for a long time. And every year that goes by, I've been out of the classroom for 11 years now as a principal for 3 years after I taught, and then assistant superintendent. I'm in my eighth year now. Every year I figure out how much further we're getting away from where we used to be and how much I don't know about it anymore. But you're exactly right. We've got to be preparing kids for jobs that aren't even created yet. And, you know, somebody said the other day when I was teaching, the kids that I was teaching had never lived in a world without a microwave. I heard somebody say the other day, you know, we've got kids coming to kindergarten that never lived in a world without a smartphone. And that's a scary thought.
Yeah.
You talk about information at their fingertips, and we're asking them to come to school in a room with no technology a lot of times, with a classroom that looks like from the 1900s, and we expect them to learn. It's almost like they're going to a foreign world. It's just very different than what they're used to. So we have to keep moving forward. We have to be giving them technology and access to the web, because that is what's going to prepare them for the future. And if we can teach them how to learn, and if we can teach them how to research, and if we can teach them or give them the technology we don't have to teach them the technology. We've got to teach them, we've got to give them the technology that they probably know how to use better than we do, so they have access to the information and you know, digital citizenship, you know, being a good citizen online. We've got to be teaching internet safety and internet etiquette and a lot of other things. You know, it makes me think about, I had a teacher's meeting yesterday. We were talking about, I don't want teachers to have these laptop devices on student desk and it be a digital dictionary or a digital encyclopedia. I wanted to change the way that we deliver instruction. And to do that, another product, again, I'm not connected to this company at all, and we've just started researching them, but it's a company called Schoology. There's other companies out there like them, whether it's Moodle or Edmodo, or there's a lot of companies out there like that, but their online solution allows you to create virtual classrooms. And those virtual classrooms, I believe, would give an avenue for our teachers to start delivering instruction differently. Because just putting a laptop on a student's desk is not going to change how a poverty kid is learning. We've got to be able to give them opportunities and virtual classrooms that they can access while they're at home or beyond the school day. So we're extending the time that they can actually be learning and the opportunities they have to learn.
Yeah, and I think that that realization of how teaching changes is a big part of you know, of integrating a new technology. You know, I think when a lot of us got computers for the first time in our classrooms, we thought, great, now we can do PowerPoint. And you know, the pedagogy that goes along with that is not necessarily an improvement. I think it's when you know, when we do realize ways to, you know, to really turn things around. When you're talking, one of the things that I thought of was Khan Academy and how they have really been promoting an approach to teaching that involves a lot of gathering information and watching explanations outside of class time, and then
Absolutely.
Using class time to actually get help from the teacher to clarify their misconceptions, and really it is a very different kind of pedagogy from just, you know, PowerPoint instead of a chalkboard, or you know, a Word document instead of a sheet of paper. There's
and
a lot
more
to it.
The laptop grant we have now is very much directed, is headed in that direction. We've had the E2T2 grants in the past, the federal money for through Title IID, the Enhancing Education Through Technology dollars in the past.
Right.
And it always seemed that that money was more of a technology deployment grant. So here's you a bunch of money, go buy a bunch of technology and stuff and use it with your kids. Well, through those grants, you know, we've got a smart board in every classroom, pre-K through grade 8, and we've got desktop computers in every classroom. Every teacher already has a laptop, and we have all these things. But we didn't see any academic achievement growth there. We didn't see that increase in scores because all of those grants were so focused on what I call technology deployment. This laptop grant, while it's going to give us a laptop for every kid, we are really going to focus on the professional development side as a district to change how we're delivering instruction. We're not going to be paying teachers to come learn how to use Word or how to use PowerPoint. Our meetings are going to be, the most instruction they're going to get is about a half an hour or an hour on here's how you use an Android device as opposed to your laptop. And then everything else is going to be classroom management with every student having in a one-to-one classroom. It's going to be setting up virtual classrooms and how to teach in a virtual classroom while you're also teaching in your current classroom. You know, what are the tools for student learning changes? So we're really looking at instructional changes, not technology deployment. And what I've noticed is before we had technology, it was just the teacher and the kids and a chalkboard, let's say. Then we added a whiteboard and thought we did something great because we could, you know, we didn't have dust flying around the room. And then we added smart boards, which were fine, because but we almost used them the exact same way. But then our teacher started actually doing some lessons in Smart Notebook, and that really provided the students some interaction with each other and using them in centers and student-driven, lessons where the kids, it almost became a center where the kids could come up and be a little more involved in the process. But this is going to take our technology another step forward, where all of our kids, and especially our poverty kids, are going to have a device right in front of them. It's going to help us differentiate learning for all of our kids in the classroom, because they can be working on different projects or different type of projects or researching at different levels with their devices.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think you really hit on the angle of the kind of incremental evolutionary change that technology can bring. You know, this is slightly better than what we had before, but when you can get to that revolutionary, a change in pedagogy, a change in what is really possible, not just a gain in some sort of efficiency or the elimination of some sort of, nuisance like chalk dust, but really a different way of approaching teaching and learning and doing things that truly were not possible before. I think that's terrific, and I think that's really commendable that you've connected that opportunity with technology to that mission of meeting the needs of all students, particularly students who are coming from less advantaged backgrounds and who are increasingly representing the population of your district. As that moves to the center of your agenda, I think that's really admirable the way that you have linked those initiatives. So thinking about your experience with working with families in poverty and working with teachers and principals to deliver a more successful experience for students, what is it that you want all school leaders to know about working with families in poverty?
I think there's quite a few things that fall under that category. One is always be looking for grant programs, grant dollars, grant opportunities to deliver services to your students in poverty. One of the big help is we were a recipient of a 21st Century Smaller Learning Communities grant through the federal government. We provide a 2.5-hour after school program that runs every day the school year runs. So we're extending the kids from poverty school day and their school year through that program. We also do a 1-month summer school for them as well. It's all academic based other than a half an hour recreation component. But that is such an important piece for them to extend that school day, and our teachers teaching that program. And so much of that's possible through community partnership. Like our Y provides the teachers for the recreation component there. A lot of our community partners come in and do presentations to kids or give them real world or hands-on applications for them. In that program, we serve over 80% minority students and over 98% poverty kids in that program. It's been such a successful program. Our community partners, such as the United Way, has been such a huge piece in that. We do something called the NOW program, Nutrition on Weekends, where they send home food on long weekends and holidays with our kids in that program so they can eat over those long weekends and holidays. We do a program at the beginning of school called Stuff the Bus that gives out backpacks and school supplies to those kids that are in the program. And at Christmas time, they do Angel Tree through Walmart, where every kid in the program takes home multiple Christmas gifts. Also, through the United Way, we're involved in the Dolly Parton Imagination Library, where we are sending home a book every month with every child in our county that signs up for it. It's totally free of charge to them. The United Way has to raise $26 a month for all of these kids. And that's something I'm proud of, our United Way. I'm actually president of that organization now, but I'm very pleased with doing Dolly Parton Imagination Library, where we're sending home children's book every month to every kid in our county that signs up free of charge. For them to keep. Yeah, they're hardback books, they're real nice books. Every kid between the ages 0 to 5 gets a book every month. So United Way's really stepped up to help us. But community partners can help you in so many different ways. These are just some of the examples we're currently doing. Providing transportation for our kids to get them to and from school. We transport all of our kids home from our after-school program. That's so essential because transportation becomes a huge problem. We work with our state and try and get some of of that reimbursed through our state reimbursement transportation program. And maybe just another idea we've not touched on, but about people, our students coming from poverty. So much of so many of our kids coming from households in poverty, they are oral-based households. Compared to middle class being text-based households. And most things are done orally rather than in text, because text and print costs money. And Dr. Donna Beagle is a great researcher to listen to one of her podcasts or read some of her material on the differences between oral-based cultures and text-based cultures. And another area that we struggled in academic achievement is our African American students. And one of the things she contends is African American families are much more oral based than Caucasian families. And that's that you start to listen to her or read to her research, and it really starts to come together about the difference between oral based and text based families.
Great, great. All right. Well, thanks so much for your time. I think that's given us a ton of great material to ponder as we look for ways to more broadly serve all of our students. And I really appreciate the way you spoke to not just the academic needs, but holistically meeting the needs of kids and families, so that that partnership between the school and the home can really function effectively to help students learn and to help students be successful. So thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for contacting me and giving me the opportunity to do it. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care. Thanks, Dr.
Okay,
Brown.
You too.
Bye-bye.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Dr. Tyler Brown of Mount Vernon School District No. 80 in Mount Vernon, Illinois. This episode of EduLeadership Radio is sponsored by Principal Center. PrincipalCenter.com is your resource for the best in professional practice from fellow school leaders. Principal Center is in private beta right now, but will be launching soon. To get your invitation, you can go to principalcenter.com and put in your email address, and you'll be given a special link that you can share with other school leaders. And the more people you refer to principalcenter.com, the higher you will go on our list for when we launch. So check it out. Again, it's principalcenter.com. If you are listening to this episode of EduLeadership Radio through the website, eduleadership.org, you might also be interested in subscribing through iTunes. If you have an iPad or an iPhone, you can go to iTunes directly on that device and search for EduLeadership and find episodes of EduLeadership Radio to download. You can also subscribe in iTunes on your computer to receive new updates automatically.